Tonight on Arena, Carrie Crowley and Damien McCann on their new film, Infus, and Brian Maguire on his life in art and activism. You can text us on 51551 or on social media at RTE Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. When we come across three female characters in a new Irish film called Infus, they are in mid-heist in their small town. The unlikely gang of local women is led by Mairead, played by Carrie Crowley, followed by her sister Coit, played by Breed Brennan, and neighbour Sheila, played by Eva Jane Gaffney. But their plot to rob the local credit union seems to be going awry, so much so that gunshots ring around the town. The film uses reverse chronology to unravel the events that lead to this standoff in the credit union. The film is a portrait of Mairead, who is trapped by her past and recent events into this foolhardy escapade. The film will screen at the Dublin International Film Festival that opens on the 20th of February. It's directed by Damien McCann, and I'm delighted to be joined by Damien and by the actress playing Mairead, Carrie Crowley. Damien, you're very welcome. Carrie, you're very welcome back to Arena. Damien, as I said, it's a heist and it seems to be going awry. And we see three women in balaclavas who are trying to rob the credit union, Mairead, Coit and Sheila. What can you tell us about the three women?
Yeah, I mean, the idea, basically, I had done one film previously called Dinion, and when I was trying to think of what I would like to do next, I had sort of a rough notion that I'd love to make a heist movie. They're the type of movies that I would watch. And so I started in on the research. My wife, Sarah Gordon, and I wrote the film together. And as part of it, I went back to where I'm from in Lurgan, and I went to talk to my parents just to say, look, you know, there's a credit union in my hometown. Has it ever been robbed before? And they were sort of saying, are you joking? It used to be robbed all the time, which I was quite surprised at. So, I was asking about that and the various robberies and stuff. And my mum said something to me that I didn't know about her before. She said, when I worked in the credit union, it was robbed. But I didn't realise she'd worked in one. So, of course, I go off on one asking about how credit unions work and how would a robbery work, just to get information together. And she said to me, if I was going to rob a credit union, here's how I would do it. And I just thought that was such an
and she wrote the plot for you.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought it was an interesting notion. You know, you stop thinking of it as, you know, a heist in terms of the mechanics of how it would work and the detail of it, and instead you start thinking about why would someone like my mum rob a credit union.
So because it's such a small town, the setting of the film, and then the whole idea of a credit union is so small, because I know a bank is everybody's money, but very much a credit union, it's the money of the people in the town.
Exactly. Again, when Sarah and I sort of sat down to look at it and we were talking about how it's usually in a lot of these small towns, the credit union's the biggest bank or the biggest building in the town. And as you say, there's something about it being the community's money, and then if you're going to rob, you're robbing from the community. And there's all of a sudden you're into interesting themes about, you know, how communities sort of help each other out and, you know, stealing from the community. And part of it, there's a thread about a quarry owner and even this idea of the quarry kind of eating into the town. You know, you sort of are able to build a small world around the credit union.
So going back to the three women then, what can you tell us about them?
So I'm very reluctant to have spoilers here so early.
Yes, they've been warning me about spoilers before they came on.
About it much, but so Mairead is our lead, and she takes it upon herself to do this. We don't yet know why she's doing this, and because the film runs backwards, we're building to exactly why she's doing it. But as part of it, she talks to others, or possibly manipulates two others. One of them being her sister, Catch,
who's the final one that I manipulate.
Yes, exactly.
Because prior to that, there was somebody else who happened to die, so we couldn't use her anymore.
Yes, exactly.
So we needed the third.
Uh-huh. And then there's another younger woman in town, Sheila, who she also manipulates. So they're, particularly the other two, Catch and Sheila, they're sort of women on the outside of society and, you know, desperate for different reasons. And our Mairead, played by Carrie here, uses that in order to talk them into this sort of madcap plan.
Yes, because Carrie, your character is wonderful. really complex. I mean, she is the manipulator. She wants to get a gang together in order to take on this heist. But she has lots of problems. She has a relationship with her sister that's problematic, relationship with her son. And then she's really somebody who wants to sort out the problems of the town as well, which were caused by the man who runs the quarry.
Yeah. So there's a huge part of Mairead that is looking for justice and looking for revenge. And then because of events that happen with the son, the gorgeous son, like she's driven, really, really driven to make this happen. And it was just such fun to do it. The only horrible part about the whole thing was the balaclavas. Let me tell you, I will never be wearing a balaclava.
You're not joining kneecap anytime soon, no.
It was just, we would laugh and cry at the same time every time we had to put them back on. And if you look at some of the photos of us, as opposed to the film itself, our eyes are squashed up into the balaclavas. And then you had to try and match it because one eye was squashed and one eye was loose. Every time you put it on, somebody had to come and just check it and put it into the right position.
In hindsight, we should have had custom balaclavas, I think.
Yeah, we should have done something different. Maybe masks. But anyway, it was kind of fun. But we had such an amount of crack making it. Mm-hmm. And the weather was appalling. We were up in Glenarm in County Antrim. It rained every day, practically. And like they'd had to get a rain machine for one scene. And by the time we'd been there a few days, everybody realised there won't be any need for...
The rain was heavier than
a rain machine. Yeah.
Now, Damien, as you mentioned, Dinan was your previous film. And that too was in Irish. There was lots of skullduggery involved in that. What are the pressures of working in the Irish language? Is casting an issue? Is getting the production together?
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference, there are lots of challenges. I mean, I don't think any more or less than any independent film, but I think certainly the benefits with Irish is that when people buy into an Irish language film, they really buy into it and they sort of understand that they're doing something more than just making an independent film. You know, they're kind of adding to this new conversation that's being had and a lot of the films that come along with it. So there are challenges. You know, I won't say there's any more or less than another independent film, but I find that certainly with our cast and, you know, crew, they're very, very dedicated, and a lot of it's because of it being an Irish language film.
And of course you were in Colleen and many other Irish films, Carrie. So working in Irish is now, I suppose it's brought you your most successful roles.
Well,
would that be fair to say?
Very interesting. I would have said this to people that when I started to become conscious of the language, I was 10 when I went to the Gaeltacht, and it was like I'd been switched into the right socket. Plugged into the right socket. Something came alive inside me. I can't explain what it was. And my Irish isn't perfect at all. There'll be people who'll say, sure, her Irish is very average. But I adore it. And I adore using her. Because in Ghaeilge, on Ghaeilge, it's a girl. I just find something about it. There's an essence in it that's really hard to find anywhere else in life. But it also makes a team of you. So the group who are working on Iontas, just you kind of come together and say, yeah, we're doing this. We're going to make this work, you know.
And it's all Irish on the set too, Damien, is it?
Well, I mean, most of the crew actually don't have Irish. I mean, some of the key, you know, obviously cast and you know, producer and a few others. But actually, primarily, it's English language. But again, do you know what I find on these as well? That a lot of the non-Irish speaking crew are very keen to learn Irish. So they kind of try, don't they? They'll ask you how to say certain words, particularly technical language. You know, they'll ask, you know, the length of lenses or the, you know, sound. People will ask about how to say a boom or, you know, how to say a sound. Or if you ask them how the take was, they'll usually tell you it was Moy or Loffa.
Or Maigador.
Or Maigador. Yeah.
And the people in makeup and hair and makeup would always want a word or two as well every day. Shintosa.
Yeah, exactly.
When they'd your face on.
So like, it's nice.
It's,
I mean, they're 18-day shoots. This was an 18-day shoot. Very, you know, there's a lot of pressure to them, but there's something. I feel very proud to have made an Irish language film, particularly one that's contemporary. I don't think there's been a heist film made in Irish before, and it gives me great enjoyment to be able to say that I've made the first. And I keep saying to people, you know, in the Irish language and film, there is no blueprint.
Everything that we're creating is sort of a first. And obviously in Callan Cuin and Kneecap have really rocketed us ahead. So I'm really excited to see what comes next from us and from others.
Well, let's hear a clip from Aenthus. As we said, Mairead has a sister and her sister is caught. She had a gang set up to do the heist, but now one has fallen out, completely out, because she's dead. So she's now going to recruit her sister caught. So when Mairead, she herself and caught are estranged. I think that's important to say. So you'll hear these kind of echoes in the conversation they're having when Mairead, Carrie's character, puts the proposal to Coit.
Your wife lom the hajarigach. Nemo hajarigach. To om. Tamikola vrapal. An horse red for sa.
Ain't the mic.
Tame dajire.
Nabi ag Januar Maggie do.
Amara. Sta is a ma gagasta. Ta ugla ohu. Come in barrier tiny a courtu a good ariat. Katitsi an aich. Tashi de bugu ariat.
Two man clue in a hurrum.
Neil me. Kegamine. And then you.
Two a giri, best there. Nia can two in a year when in Shaw. He'll have not liad and chimma de veil. Ach, Sean Witch.
Sean Witch. Kay, a tammy's only Ursa. Namisha.
August and Shinja Jay. Emma Mexico.
She's deciding that where are they going to go when the heist is over. So Breed Brennan there playing Coit and Carrie Crowley, of course, playing Mairead in the new film Aenthus. So Damien, it's shot in this way. We see the heist first and then it goes in reverse chronological order. Is that the right way of putting it? So why did you choose that method to tell the story?
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things. It felt, a lot of times in heist films, what happens is you find out why people need the money and then you see what they do and how they do it. And, you know, myself and Sarah have always been more interested in characters as opposed to plot. And so when you switch the order, what happens is you see what happens and how it happens and you're building towards a why. And in particular, a scene like that, you've got two estranged sisters that are doing this together. There's something interesting in that the plan itself is quite simple. And they can do it. They can succeed. What is complex are the relationships between the three of them. And if they can just get out of each other's way and work together, hence the title, Ain't This? If they can just work together on it, they'll be fine.
Yes, Carrie, because there is that complex relationship between Coit and Mairead. I mean, they ignore each other when they pass each other on the tiniest little footpath in this small little town.
And the whole town knows that they haven't spoken in a very long time and why they haven't spoken. So everybody throws in their tuppence worth every now and again. Somebody will say why we don't speak, but we don't say why we don't speak at all until towards the end. And
you've worked with Breed quite recently.
Yeah, we were both lucky enough to be in Donaghadee in Hope Street. And again, we were sisters. It is bizarre, but there you have it. So it was really nice to work together. The only two times that I've worked with her, and we were sisters, Trifurcha, Sandorod. So that was kind of nice.
And does this reverse chronology affect the actors in any way? Because you'd often be shooting out of sync, wouldn't you, with the plot?
Yeah, you would. Like sometimes you shoot the final scene on the first day. So it can be very weird. You just have to really know your timeline all the time, or have it written down somewhere so that you can go back and check and say, that happens first. But in this, because it was in the writer's hands, the pair of them, we just had to go, yeah, whatever. We'll follow. You just tell us what you want and we'll deliver.
And was it very precise then that you had to stick to the script really because you knew all the elements you had to reverse to give us insight into these characters?
The difficulty in writing it was you kind of have to decide whether you're going to write it backwards in that order or are you going to write it forwards and then move the pieces around. And we decided to write it backwards because that's how the audience is going to watch it. But the tricky bit there is you have to write it backwards, but you always have to keep the forward story in your head at the same time because you don't want to tweak something that then messes up the actual proper chronology of it. But what, you know, what a Carrie Crowley gives you is really, you know, the plot, you know, the plot and that, the mechanics of that in itself are interesting and they're intricate. And Carrie, Breege, they really ground the characters for you then, which is important because you don't want it feeling too overly complex or, you know, that you maybe get a lost in the thread of the plot. And Carrie, Breege, Eva Jane, they really just kind of ground you in those characters and make sure it stays rooted as a character piece as opposed to a plot-heavy heist movie.
Tell us about some of the male characters in the film.
Ooh, which one will we start with?
Well, let's start with the bad guys.
Okay, Marcus Lamb and Shaun T. O'Malley. They were great. Shaun T, and I don't know if you could see it when you watched it, but he had a gold tooth that he wore all the time. Which he brought himself. It was a fake nail that had gold varnish on it. And he would stick it onto one of his teeth and he'd gold chains, like rotten stuff. He just was such a schlieveen.
Yes, and he's the partner of the third person in the heist. Yeah. This is Sheila.
Yeah,
he's not a nice person.
He is awful. He's awful. So all of us would love to see him out of the picture. But his brother, played by Marcus Lamb, is the one who really is destroying the town and has such an ego and everything has to be done his way. And all any of us want is to see the back of him, if possible. Do we? I don't know. People just have to come to the film and see.
There is a very nice male character in it who plays your sidekick.
Oh, Art Parkinson. And he's just so gorgeous. And he's the young kind of rookie guard. And his dad is in it as well. And he's just so funny, genuinely funny as a person anyway.
Yes.
But in that part, when I watched it back, I just laughed every time I saw him walk into the scene, and just because he was a real ditherer as the guard. He couldn't be a guard, really. He should never have been a guard. All he wanted to do was travel.
Yes, and he keeps messing up as the guarder. So it's quite, it brings a wonderful level of humour into a film that can in sometimes be quite dark.
Yeah, I love the fact that he's there because it is the light relief. And even the fact that then he's learning languages, which becomes quite important in it. Mm. He's learning so that he can go and travel the world. But anyway, it's worth watching for him alone.
Have fun with the reverse chronology. Did I see coffee pots percolating backwards and the like?
There is, yeah, there. When you're going backwards, it effectively the film jumps back in 10-minute chunks. So there's maybe 9, 10-minute chunks. And there was we were writing the script. It was hard to know how to tell an audience you were going backwards. And so we come up with this motif that happens in between those chunks where you see backwards imagery. And for a start, they're nice. You know, the images are nice to look at. It also tells you going backwards. But then you find out later on that they're also important within themselves. So again, that's what you're always trying to, we call it double beat, you know, a scene where you have something that looks good, that it works to tell an audience something, but it also functions in another way in terms of the wider plot.
I remember one of those backward kind of moments, and it was the falling cup. And then to watch it when it had been filmed and to watch it, just all the coffee going back up into the cup and it landing back on the table. And we all went, that's it. That's it. It's there.
And it was the first cup. We bought 50 cups to smash them because we thought it would take 50. And it smashed on the first one. And we were excited because I remember there was a moment when we watched it back and you had a thought of, oh, we're making a movie. And it was so, you forget about it when you're in the kind of drudgery of it, you're trying to get through the day. And it was one of those moments where you're like, oh, we're doing this.
Now, you're showing it at the Dublin International Film Festival. Is this its first viewing?
We had it in Santa Barbara a few days ago there in California, so it had two screenings out there. That was its world premiere, and Diff will be its European premiere, which is lovely because it's the home of so many of the cast and cast family and things like
that.
What
was the reaction in America?
Great. Like I was saying to Carrie, you know, 20 past 8 in the morning, the first screening was, which I thought would be quiet, and it was packed out. And great, again, to hear the Irish language in California. There was two. There was another film that Carrie and Sean Tier also in called Froggy, and they played back-to-back, and it was kind of amazing to hear the language, the Irish language, back-to-back in California, and it was special. So it's on Diff this Saturday at 6 o'clock as
yes.
well. So
with
so,
a Q&A afterwards.
With the Q&A afterwards.
With the two of you?
Yes,
or with the
yes. we'll be up there,
and
yeah.
And Breach will be and there
Breach,
as well.
And Eva Jane think, and yeah. Sarah. Yeah.
Well, very good. Well, Aenthas will be screened at Dublin International Film Festival on Saturday, as you said. That's February 22nd at 6 p.m. More information on the festival, which opens on the 20th, from diff.ie. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. For more than four decades, the artist Brian Maguire has explored the aftermath of conflict and violence, going into war zones, prisons and the homes of the bereaved to make his art. He is perhaps best known for the aftermath of the Mexican drug war, when the women who were murdered in Juarez City. These were crimes that went largely unpunished. A new documentary, The Life of Brian, goes out on RT1 television this Thursday evening, and an exhibition of his works, La Grande Illusion, is currently on at the Dublin Hugh Lane Gallery. Jess Fahey covered that for us some weeks ago. I'm delighted that Brian Maguire, the artist himself, is with me now in the studio. So Brian, a documentary about you. You're usually the person, I think you made a film yourself about Juarez, yeah. and now you're being the person observed. Is that a change of role for you?
Oh, it is indeed. I rang the director, Mark McLaughlin, 4 minutes ago to ask him why he made it, because I knew this would be your first question, and he said that he liked the work, okay, but that it was the international stories that he wanted to tell. The painting is the tip of an iceberg. Beneath it, there are stories.
Yes, because maybe we'll go through some of those yeah. stories, because these stories are re-represented at the Grand Illusion yeah. in the Hugh Lane, and also very much interrogated in the film The Life of Brian. So maybe we'd start with Juarez, if you yeah. think that that's a yeah. good place to start. So that was about femicide, the whole issue of women disappearing and mm-hmm. being murdered. What was the reason for that?
Well, we don't know, because there's never been a satisfactory criminal justice prosecution in relation to the large numbers. The odd one where the partner was responsible, yes, those things can get picked up. But there were 80 young women where the MO was the same. And then there was another 80 where the MO was the same. It was different. But and those 160, nobody was ever caught for them. There were rumours available in the city, like everywhere, and you can hear. But nobody knows. These women are all young. They're all brown. And they're all quite beautiful. They worked in the Macadores, the factories that were set up after the free trade agreement with Clinton. The manufacturing base of America moved to Mexico. Wages plummeted from $1,000 a week to 50. And somebody preyed on these young women. And
you go in then as an artist, a solo, yeah. and you begin to get to know the people, the yeah. families of the victims.
Yeah, I was, I had some contacts in Texas, and they put me in touch with an NGO, a school teacher, who had founded an organization to support the mothers who'd lost their kids, And they made it. She made a deal with me. She said, you teach the orphans art and I'll introduce you to the families. I was, that's a deal made in heaven. You know, it was a joyful entry. I remember the fun we had in the art class, followed by a very...
And these are the orphans of the young women.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, right.
And, but the following day, I met the mother of one of Rebecca, and she was really, 5 years earlier, Rebecca had been killed, and the woman, I don't think the mum left the couch. You know, she was devastated. Now, I met other women, other grannies. There was one, Arce was her name. She was in Dublin at Frontline Defenders. She had been to Dublin, so, you know. But what she did was she knew a policeman had taken her daughter. And so she went around all the cop shops and left leaflets continually, hassled them, harassed them. So much so that they surrounded her house with three Crossley tenders, so three big, you know, those.
Yes, yes.
Used to have them in
intimidating, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you couldn't intimidate this woman. She wrote poetry about it. She put the poetry to song. She's a woman of 80.
And now, Brian, you know, the art you made with them is unlike other artworks we're going to talk about. These were portraits.
Yeah,
they're
portraits.
And why did you choose portraits of these disappeared and murdered young women?
Well, I wanted, there's kind of two, it's like there's like two perspectives. The first is the family. So you make a memorial picture for the family and you give it to them. And that's it. It's over. The second one is to tell the public what has happened. And you can do that because the pictures they gave me are the pictures we all have in our houses of our kids when they look fabulous. That's the, you know, and often in some houses there was only one picture. I had to be careful because I lose everything, not to take the picture, but to photograph it and stuff. But it was to present these beautiful young women and show the world what was taken.
Now, can we cross across the border to El Paso?
Yeah.
And there you were very interested in people who make that treacherous journey from Mexico into America in the hope of better times. So how, again, did you approach that?
Well, we were lucky in the sense that we were Mark and I were looking. Mark was helping me. Looking for somebody who would give me an entry into that story, and it came in the guise of the chief medical officer.
This is Greg Hess.
Yeah, yes, Greg made we made the agreement in 3 minutes in his office. He said, I suggested that I would paint the pictures, but I needed him to give them to me. So he said, come back in a month. For 2 months.
So Greg is the guy on the front line. He is seeing these bodies and he is actually in charge of some of the bodies.
Yeah, all of them.
Maybe we'll listen to a clip of Greg from the documentary The Life of Brian, where he's showing you a skeleton.
That's right.
All of these boxes on both sides, it gets a little tight in here. These are all skeletal remains. All these labels, all unidentified. So here's a case that was found in 2020 and a case that was found in 2021. And you can see we got quite a bit of skeleton here.
Yeah.
And this is the case that was recovered in 2021. And here all we have is a part of a weathered cranium. This is the top of the cranium. We're missing the bones of the face. We're missing the maxillary jaw. We're missing the mandible. We took a section for DNA, so this is the occipital bone at the back of the skull, and that's all that's present. This is white, it's sun-bleached, it is older. This likely represents somebody that died months to potentially a couple years before they were recovered.
Yeah.
And then this person, you can see the consistency of the bones is quite a bit different. So this is a little bit more yellowed. This person was recovered more recently to when they died. And the fact that we have much more of a complete skeleton just gives an indication of vastly different ages of these types of skeletal remains.
That's Greg Hess, who is the chief medical officer on the border there. Yeah. I mean, you worry these days now under Trump about Greg and his work and what is going to happen now.
He's in Arizona, and Arizona is divided between, you know, those who help migrants and those who don't.
Now, again, Brian, when you saw that skeleton and then when you see the photographs, how does your artistic brain work in terms of how are you going to create those images?
Well, there are two things immediately come to mind. He had set up I took 90 cases from the 400 he had set up for me, two computers, and you take it from one to the other, and I can go home with it.
You mean cases as in people and their situation?
It's cases of the body being found. The ones I didn't take were the ones that were just too gruesome for me. I just couldn't. There was a section I wasn't able to cope with. So that was the first cut. The second one was that I tried to make sure that the face was not visible, that you couldn't identify the figure, because I don't know the name of the person. They are nameless people in the sense that they don't carry ID coming through for obvious reasons. Now, Greg works, his responsibility is to house the remains, keep it safe in the hope that someday it might become possible to do a DNA. But for DNA, you need to have something to measure it against, which is a relative.
Yes, yes.
You know, you can't get DNA on its own. So,
and Brian, why paintings? Why do you think? I mean, you are a painter. I know why you paint. But in terms of what do you think a painting rather than a reproduction of a photograph does?
Well,
for what you're trying to represent.
Well, I remember Laura Marlowe, the Irish Times journalist, told me that after about 7 years, photos that she knows are there, she can't find them. They're gone. I know there's a multitude of photos due to the cameras. The idea of making a painting, now the painting, if the community, and I don't just mean this one, but the one that'll come after us, if they respect it, they'll mind it. And the image will remain.
Do you think there's something about paint, though, and like the whole painting tradition that gives, I don't know, I mean, it is so grave and so terrible, but gives it some kind of monumentality or something?
Well, I think the fact that they're made by hand gives them, you know, the difference between a piece of furniture that a man has made by hand and one that has being poured in plastic is huge. Mm-hmm. And it's in that area, I think, that painting has remained with us. I don't know why, but I came to paint, to the College of Art, to paint, to learn, before the photography and video had arrived. It was painting. That's how we used to communicate. And that's what I learned. So I'm a victim of my age, in the sense.
And Brian, when you were working there, you're working from photographs, but are you working sometimes in the midst of the very people you're painting? You know, there was some workshops in the film where we could see you painting. So is that interesting for you to be observed?
Yeah. Well, that we went specially to Margolis because the people who are coming, the migrants who are coming from Central America and south of Mexico, we wanted to talk to them, to listen to what they had to say about why are they there and where are they going and what are they looking for. Because there's so much misinformation, particularly in the US, about this. I wanted to combat that. And indeed, I'm so proud of that, the beauty of that clip and of those people, of their gentleness. They're fleeing from, they've been accused by Trump of being criminals.
Exactly. That's what he's trying to say, that the cartels are flooding in over the border.
They're an invasion. They're young men and women and their children who are fleeing that kind of thing. They're running from it. That's why they're there. And they made the drawings and they made the paintings of what they wanted. And one man painted himself tiling a roof, you know. Like, the evidence of their decency is in those paintings.
And Brian, do you think that that is what spurs you on from the very beginning, that sense of inequality in the, in our own country and then in the wider global situation?
Yeah, I do, you know. You're absolutely on the money there. You know, that is where the energy comes from. You know, I've often said that it's a kind of revenge gives you energy. You know, it's...
So let's listen to some of the people who speak in the documentary. This is The Life of Brian. This is Alison Spellacy. Alison's a former director of the Fergus McCaffrey Gallery in New York. And here she talks about your work, Brian's work.
The experience with the United Nations and Ambassador Geraldine Byrne's invitation for Brian to participate in what is a brief but very meaningful exhibition that taking place now, it's very interesting to see these two communities intersect, because normally there would be very little overlap. His painting is the perfect extension of the man himself. It struck me that the 20 years that we've been working with Brian is only a small part of what the man has actually produced in terms of his career arc. I can comfortably say, after knowing Brian for a couple of decades now, that he's messy, he's unpredictable, he's incorrigible, he's relentless. It feels that there are decades more of work to be done.
There's Alison Spellacy of the Fergus McCaffrey. Messy and unreliable. That's not great.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's
you the, like that.
Oh, it's the best. Yeah.
And Brian, do you feel, you know, you are a male, white painter in the Western tradition. Like, how do you get over that when you are then, you know, looking for permission to paint people of a different colour?
Listen, I was in Browning, which is in Montana. It's an Indian town, a Native American town.
Yes, this is recently. You're just back there.
Yeah, I'm just back, but this was 4 years ago. And I had brought the first portrait. And I asked the man who was teaching in the school there, I said, "What do you think of a white man doing this?" And he said, "White man?" I said, "You're not a white man. You're an Irish man." And then what he said next, because remember, I'm a Maguire, he said, "The plantation of Ulster." Now, I've travelled all over the world and nobody in Europe or America or anywhere else had ever mentioned the plantation of Ulster to me. But he was a Crowell man, he knew about it because it was the same people that run them off their land that run the Maguires off their land all those years ago.
Right, so there was an affinity.
I don't have anything to apologise for when colonialist countries turn around to me and say, "You're a white elderly man." I am that. But I also have another experience which a lot of us on this island share.
Brian, is there a painting from the Grand Illusion? Is there something that is, for you, is the definitive in terms of Brian Maguire? Is there something that you would say, do you want to know what Brian Maguire's work is like? Look at that.
Well, the kind of There is, as with every show, there's one painting that there's a consensus about, and that's the blue one, the figure in the Mediterranean.
That's what that's what I would have suggested myself. Yeah. Could you just describe that painting? Your style it comes across as very simple, very gestural, but I'm sure it's not.
Well, there's two things here. There's the kind of the meaning of the painting and the image and the meaning of it, which is a man drowning. But then it's how do you do it? And that's something different. That's a technical thing, and it's to do with space and to do with water. I did a painting 30 years ago, 40 years ago, called Liffey Suicides, of people. I saw a crowd standing on the bridge, in the O'Connell Bridge, and I was wondering what they were doing. And they were waiting on somebody to be brought up. And I made a painting after that. I thought it was a significant event in our city.
And in the same way then, that this is a painting of a migrant.
This is Europe. I mean, the earlier one was about Dublin and about the river disposing of people instead of giving, I mean, the city's there because of the river. But then the Mediterranean now is, I mean, it's unthinkable what has happened.
Yes. Well, Brian Maguire, it's been a pleasure talking to you. The Life of Brian Maguire goes out at 10:15 on RT1 on the 20th of February. And Brian Maguire's La Grande Illusion exhibition is at the Hugh Lane Gallery now until the 18th of May. Further details from hughlane.ie.
Thank you.
Adelphi 63 is a new play about the events in Dublin on a night in November 1963. The Beatles made their first and only appearance in Dublin at the Adelphi Cinema on Abbey Street. Writer and actor Laura Brady is behind the story of Beatlemania, youthful rebellion and sisterhood against the backdrop of a city grappling with change. Through historical events and original storytelling, the play explores the resilience of joy amidst oppression. And the inspiration for the film was a clip that Laura saw on Reeling in the Years. It was an episode where we heard reporter Frank Hall talk to fans outside the Adelphi and then to the Beatles themselves in 1963.
What is it about these fellas that brings you out at that hour of the day?
Oh, no, they're just gorgeous.
They're what?
They're gorgeous.
Well, now, be a bit more explicit. I mean, what is it? Is it the singing or the hair or what?
The singing and the hair and the jackets.
And is that all?
No, everything, I don't know. The way they sing and everything.
Well, what about you?
I like the way they sing.
The way they sing? What way do they sing? I've never heard them.
They have a great beat to every song.
Give us a sort of an idea.
Do you love me?
Or, like what?
She loves you, what is it?
She loves you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She loves you.
Yeah.
She loves you, yeah.
Mates for quite a long time, so we don't get on each other's nerves as much as we could. We're quite friendly.
What a clip there from Reeling in the Years, the clip that inspired my next guest, Laura Brady, to write a play, a new play called Adelphi 63. What was it about that clip? Is it the joie de vivre? Is it the music? Is it the Beatles themselves, Laura?
Well, I remember watching the episode of Reeling in the Years and thinking, God, I love those girls. I love their energy. I love their spirit. Like, you know, they caused a riot on the middle of Abbey Street. And I thought, that would be a really good play. you know.
Fantastic. Bring us back to that time in 1963, because I know you've researched it exhaustively. So the Beatles came and they did two concerts on the one night in the Adelphi. And I think they were staying in the Gresham. Is that right?
Yeah, they were indeed. So, yeah, they had I believe it was a 6:30 show and then another show at 9 o'clock. And the Adelphi Cinema, it holds about 2,300 people, or it held, rather. And so, you know, they had the 6:30 show. They had 2,300 people coming out onto Middle Abbey Street. But then they had the 9 o'clock show with 2,300 people going in.
And I see a problem.
But that's not to mention all the people who showed up who didn't have the money for a ticket. You know, loads of accounts, people saying, like, oh, it was great crack. I'm sure it would have been even better if you were inside, you know.
Now, you say you were inspired by those wonderful young women that Frank Hall spoke to all those years ago. And your play has it as its centre, two characters, Mary and Bridget. And Laura, you're director and you're also in the play along with Jessica Servi.
Yeah, Jessica is playing Bridget and I'm playing Mary, but I have a wonderful director, Shamey Campbell, and he is steering the ship for the directing. And I was very inspired by the women more so than the Beatles. Although I'm fast becoming a bigger Beatles fan the more I look at their work. But I found it really, like, I had the idea for the play years ago, but then I was researching a lot, like looking at old newspaper articles about it, and the journalists at the time, like, I mean, they had such disregard for what they called hysterical young girls, you know, with low IQs, or they would describe them like a fat girl with a shocked look on her face, you know, like the language they used to describe these women, who I found, you know, like uplifting. So was shocking to me. So I thought, well, hold on a minute. Maybe it's time to kind of tell a story from the women's point of view or the girls' point of view. So that's kind of the driving force of my piece.
Yes, and we hear all that joy and enthusiasm and then the Beatles sounding so modern. But there was two Irelands then. There was this youthful upsurge, but it was against the backdrop of a very conservative Ireland, a conservative Ireland already written about around that time by people like Edna O'Brien.
That's it, Kay. I'm a huge Edna fan, and I find this period of time fascinating. Like 1963, it just alone, like you have the visit of JFK and then the ultimate assassination of him, or, you know, you had Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. But in Ireland itself, like, you know, tenement, like, houses were collapsing around tenants, and there was a lot of poverty, a cost of living crisis. So the young women and teenagers who had such joy, like, it was a great form of resilience, and that's, in context, that's what I'm very interested in. And it's kind of what drew me to the period in general. Like, what does it take for young people in Ireland to cause a riot of thousands of people?
So tell us about the two characters then that you've created to try and tell that story, Mary and Bridget. They're quite different, aren't they?
They're talking to you, Kay. They are really different. Mary is 16 and Bridget is 17, but there could be like 5 years between them. Mary is very into the Beatles, but like she can't afford to go. So she's doing the Decades of the Rosary and she's praying every day, and she's very connected to her religion, but she's using it to get Beatles tickets. And Bridget then has finished her intercert and she's working in St. Augustine Street in the Two L's textile factory there, and she doesn't have a kind of as much youthful joy as her little cousin. So seeing them kind of experience the same world but in different ways is something I'm interested in telling. Like, Mary is really into her fantasies of the boy bands, but then Bridget has an older boyfriend. So it's kind of like exploring desire, but into one very innocent way and then one not so innocent, you know.
And what do you think was the effect of the music on those girls? Was it a kind of liberating force, or was it a false dawn?
That's such a good question. I think, like, and it's something I'm really digging into and still, like, exploring. Like, it's more than music, I think. Like, even when in the clip that you played there, I love it so much. He's like, what do you like about them? And they're like, their jackets, they're gorgeous. You know, like, it's a whole movement. And the thing about the Beatles is, like, they were, if nothing, just four friends from working class areas. And they were pretty young too at this point. So I think there was something that young people really found magnetic about them. And yeah, the music was different and new, but so was the way that they were behaving, you know. So it's a whole world as well as a music movement.
Yes, and you're having great fun with it. I think there is an appearance of the Beatles in the play. Would that be right?
Well, let me tell you, there's some fancy Beatles wig work that's happening and some dodgy Scouse accents, but we're working on it.
in relation to the women then, do they go on a journey of either self-discovery or coming to understand that they're more trapped than they are liberated?
Yeah, you know what? Like, this is it. Like, this is a story about friendship where, yeah, it's kind of like an odyssey through Dublin in 1963. One night, you know, like different characters they meet, but also a story of them coming together. And that these cousins live together. They spend every week and minute together, but they're kind of at odds. And they realise kind of throughout the journey that, you know, they find each other and that their friendship and sisterhood is more important than any boy band. And so, yeah, there's a real physical journey, and then there's also a real emotional journey that we go through.
And I guess you're going to get the crowd on their feet, are you, with lots of music?
At the end, I hope so. That's it. Yeah, it's been such a joy to try and even build a soundtrack to the piece. Like, spoiled for a choice, you know. It's in the Festival of Newark, Seen and Heard, which I have to say is just such a brilliant place to create for theatre makers. I just find the festival brilliant. Jacqueline Dukes and Caoimhe Connolly, what they do there, it's really invites us to be bold.
That's right. I was at a show last week, and just, you know, the way the cast and crews of other shows support each other, it's really fantastic.
It's lovely. Yeah.
Now, Laura Brady, thank you so much for talking to us. Adelphi 63 will be at Smock Alley on Tuesday the 25th and Wednesday the 26th as part of the Seen and Heard Festival. More details from smockalley.ie. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. James Feeney was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, and the show was produced by Reg Luby. And John Creedon is next.